Cheetah on Main Street in Margaretville. 845-586-4177 or hgom.net. The Pack Attack and Farmers Market in Halkettsville, celebrating holidays in the Catskills with locally prepared foods, local crafts, and unique gifts. Saturday, November 29th from 10 to 1. The Pack Attack and Farmers Market is at the Round Barn on Route 30 in Halkettsville.
Welcome to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains. I'm Diana Mason, the host of this program that usually airs on Wednesdays from 2 to 3 o'clock. And we focus on the local, state, national, and global issues and the impact that they have on the lives of the individuals, families, and communities in the central Catskill region. Well, today, we're going to focus on the impact of recent federal health and social policy changes on the health and well-being of the people in this region. We'll also talk about how the state and individuals and organizations in our communities are responding. There has been a sense of urgency about the current and future impact of some of these changes that are or are not occurring at the federal level that potentially threaten or do threaten the access to health care and safety net programs like SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. The recent political battle over what's called the continuing resolution on the budget that is needed to keep the government open when a full budget for a new fiscal year has not passed Congress resulted in the longest shutdown of the federal government in our nation's history, as the Democrats held out from supporting the budget resolution because they wanted to restore tax credits that were included in the Affordable Care Act and extended during COVID, as well as changes from what was called the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that passed Congress and was signed into law by President Donald Trump earlier this year. We'll talk about these changes and how they can affect everyone in our community, regardless of whether, for example, you can afford health insurance or not. But it's not just changes in health insurance coverage that are affecting the health of people. We know that what's called the social determinants of health play a much more significant role in promoting the health of people than actually healthcare does. These include things like access to affordable, nutritious food, access to safe, affordable housing, a quality education for children and adults, jobs that pay a living wage, businesses that thrive, and how safe we feel in our communities. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, for example, cuts $186 billion of funding for the SNAP program and imposes work requirements and more bureaucratic reporting of one's eligibility for SNAP, changes that we know are expected to reduce or totally cut off SNAP supports for over 7 million people in the country and almost 700,000 New Yorkers. And yet, SNAP is demonstrated to be one of the most effective anti-hunger programs in the country. And this, we know it reaches about 42 million people. And this, I think, is really important. For every dollar that you invest in SNAP, for every dollar in the SNAP program, you stimulate $1.80 in economic activity in communities. And that's really important to the businesses in our community. So we'll touch on some of these social services that are crucial to our neighbors, our friends and family members, maybe even ourselves, who may not be able to afford nutritious food or heat, have heat assistance, or have access to adequate housing, but also to our entire community. When you cut Medicaid, you cut an important revenue stream for hospitals and other healthcare organizations that we all use. And this jeopardizes their survival and everyone's access to healthcare. So during this 2 hours, we want to hear from you, our listeners. You can email us your questions and comments at healthceteracatskills@gmail.com. That's healthcetera, C-E-T-E-R-A, Catskills with an S at the end, at gmail.com. And we'll get to as many questions and comments as we can. Some of you have already emailed some in, and we're going to try to get your questions in. But any that we don't, I will follow up with a response to you. I'll feed out questions to our guests today and have them respond as well, and we will follow up with you. I do want to note that our focus today is on the policy changes, not the political dynamics of Washington, D.C., or New York State, or locally. So please focus on the policy issues at hand. We do want to hear from you, feel free to, throughout the program, to email us with your questions and comments. Today, and I want to just hang on a minute. I want to just outline today's program for you. We're going to be starting off with Congressional Representative Congressman for our this district, Josh Riley, discussing the changes that occurred under the One Big Beautiful Bill Act and the health-related issues that led to the shutdown of the federal government. We'll then talk with two leaders of local hospitals about the impact of these federal changes on their health systems. Carolyn Lewis will join us from the Bassett Health System, and Michael Hockman from Margaretville and Mountainside Residential Care Center, that are both parts of Health Alliance of the Hudson Valley and WMC Health. At the top of the second hour, we'll talk with Middletown Supervisor Glenn Faulkner and Roxbury Town Supervisor Alan Hinckley about what they're seeing among their community members and how their towns are responding, and some thoughts about what we all can do to respond. Assemblyman Brian Maher was to join us live, but he's actually in the Navy Reserves and is being deployed. And so I recorded a brief interview with him this morning, and I will share that interview with him that I had with him. We did invite Assemblyman Chris Tagg and Senator Peter Oberacker to join us, but they were not available. We'll end the special with three guests to talk about what they are seeing in terms of the social care needs of people in our region and how their organizations are responding. These guests will be Delaware County Commissioner of Social Services Keith Weaver, CEO of Delaware Opportunities Shelley Bartow, and the founder and manager of the Hub in Margaretville, Robin Williams. We'll also talk throughout about how we can all step up to help our neighbors. So get your pens and papers ready to note these, but we are going to compile a list of resources that are mentioned during this 2 hours, and we will post this list on the website of The Hub at thehubonmaine.org. That's two B's in Hub, thehubonmaine.org. I will also be posting it to the Health Cetera website at healthmediapolicy.com. That's healthmediapolicy.com. I also want to note that at the station today is Andy Cahill of the Andy Cahill Show, that is one of my favorite shows on this station, that airs on Sundays from noon to 2. She's going to be monitoring those emails and also sharing them with my co-host today. And my co-host today is Richard Siegel, a social work administrator who now teaches policy part-time in the social work program at Hunter College. He's also vice chair of the board of directors for Margaretville Hospital, where I'm also a board member. Richard, thanks so much for joining me today to do this. And should we just proceed with introducing our first guest?
Diana, thank you very much. It is my absolute pleasure to introduce our first guest. His name is Josh Riley. He is our representative in New York 19th District. He is a fifth generation upstate New Yorker from Endicott, and he has worked as a policy analyst at the U.S. Department of Labor and as a counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee. Josh Riley has also been a huge supporter of health care up here in the Catskills, so we appreciate him very much. Welcome, Congressman. We wanted to address two quick things. Well, not two quick things, but two things quickly. First one is the whole issue about whether the Affordable Care Act subsidies will expire or not in 6 weeks. That's the immediate thing. And then the second issue is, what, if any, options do you think there are that some of the worst parts of the Medicaid cuts that aren't scheduled to go into effect till the end of next year might be modified in the coming year? So, Congressman, please take it as you would like.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. And this is such an important issue. We are in the middle of a crisis with respect to access to health care in rural America, and we're seeing that across upstate New York. I've talked to so many nurses. I was just down at SUNY Sullivan a couple weeks ago for a town hall focused on rural health care, and talking to the nurses there and how hard that profession is, how overworked and underpaid folks are. I've talked to so many people who need care, especially seniors who are struggling to get it. And of course, you had mentioned our hospital systems are barely hanging on by a thread. And so on the issue of ACA subsidies, my hope had been that in the course of these last budget negotiations, we would have been able to bring both the Democrats and the Republicans to the table to extend those subsidies. It's really important across upstate New York, where thousands and thousands of folks are getting their health care on an exchange. It's especially important for our small businesses who depend on it. And I've always said I will work with anybody, Democrat or Republican, who wants to do right by upstate New York. And so I'm holding out hope that there can be some good bipartisan conversations to get those extended. I think the points that were raised earlier about the impact of Medicaid cuts are really worth reinforcing. With the big, beautiful bill, H.R. 1, that is going to take about $1 trillion out of the public health system. And that's devastating in any case. It's especially devastating in rural communities across upstate New York. About 40% of the kids in our congressional district are on Medicaid, about 30, 35% of folks overall, half of the babies, 70% of the seniors who are in nursing facilities are on Medicaid. And when you take $1 trillion out of the public health system, it has devastating impacts, not just for those folks and the folks who are providing services to them, but this is actually going to impact healthcare across the board for folks who are in the middle class as well, because we are going to start seeing a lot of folks go without the care that they need, going to emergency rooms, and that is going to drive up costs across the board. And so this is something that really, I voted against it for that reason, and it's something that we really need to try to address and mitigate the damage for. I'm trying to do that. I'm really proud to have recently secured funding in the budget for Margaretville Hospital to revamp its primary care facilities, funding for RFUA, which is a federally qualified health center in Sullivan County. So we're trying to provide the support that we can and mitigate the damage. But make no mistake, H.R. 1 is going to cause a lot of harm across upstate New York.
So for those of you who don't understand, very quickly, the subsidies were put in place a few years ago. So if the subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, which are people that are just above the Medicaid level of eligibility but are getting insurance, their premiums could increase dramatically, some doubling or tripling, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. So there are folks who make too much money to be eligible for Medicaid, but too little money to have a secure middle class life. And in that situation, you can get health insurance on the exchange. And as I mentioned before, small businesses in particular depend on the exchange and the essential plans to make sure that their employers or their employees have access to the health care they need. And when these subsidies expire, you're exactly right. We could see premiums double, in some cases triple. And let's remember, that is happening in the context of an affordability crisis that is more general than that. Probably the number one thing I hear about around the district and with calls into our office are the rising utility bills. People are getting crushed with high utility costs. Sometimes now those utility bills are as much as the mortgage or the rent. You add to that rising costs for things like groceries rent and mortgages. And then on top of all that, if you're going to double or triple folks' insurance premiums, it becomes absolutely unsustainable.
So looking into your crystal ball, Congress has about 6 weeks, maybe a little less. What is the likelihood that something might be done before the end of Christmas?
I'm an eternal optimist. Yeah, look, I'm an eternal optimist. I'm part of a bipartisan group in the House that is getting together to try to work on a solution to this problem. And I've always said I'll work with anybody from any party who's trying to do right by upstate New York. And my hope is that we have a good bipartisan group that's able to put something together, because we just can't afford to have the premiums double or triple on folks across upstate New York. There's a host of other things that I also think we need to do to improve access to healthcare in upstate New York and rural communities. I'm going to bring a lot of those ideas to the table. They include things like making sure we have telehealth available to folks and that it's covered by Medicare and Medicaid and insurance. Because one of the things we learned from COVID is that you can actually get some pretty good treatment for some acute issues using telehealth. I think broadband access is a public health issue for that reason. I want to see us expand the school-based health center model that Bassett Hospital is doing so incredibly well in Otsego and parts of Delaware County. That's a model that puts doctor's offices — this isn't just the school nurse's office, this is a full-scale doctor's office — in the schools. And what that means is kids can get access to the care they need right down the hall. Mom and dad don't have to miss shifts at work to take their kids to appointments. So there's a host of things like that that I think we also really need to be focused on and doing. I'm sponsoring legislation to have Medicare cover vision and dental, which is something that there's no reason we shouldn't be doing that too. And most recently, I'm holding the insurance companies accountable. We've seen a number of those insurance companies pull their Medicare Advantage plans out of rural America. They are literally kicking seniors off of healthcare just because it's less profitable to serve rural America. And meanwhile, their corporate executives and lobbyists are making a fortune, and that's just completely not fair. And we've got to put a stop to that too.
So the Medicare changes, the goal of the Medicare changes is to cut people off of the coverage. I think the ideology behind that is that people ought to be taking care of themselves more than the government taking care of them. One of the things, if I understand it correctly, is instead of recertifying and proving you're meeting the work requirements annually, people are going to now have to do that twice a year. Is that in fact correct? And what are the likelihood that that might change?
Yeah, that's a part of it. And it's for Medicaid. Sorry, Diane.
If I could just add, I think you're talking about Medicaid, right, Richard?
Medicaid.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So part of the way these cuts are being implemented, you're right. They are making the bureaucracy and the red tape more onerous on folks. And look, I think most people agree that if you can work, you should work. Most folks who are on Medicaid or SNAP are, in fact, already working. And so what they're doing is just adding additional hurdles to jump through. And they know that that is going to end up resulting in a lot of people who are eligible, who are working, losing their health insurance. I think that's immoral, for one thing. But I think it's also really bad economics, because you think about these families who are talking about These are families where mom and dad are picking up extra shifts on the weekends, working at relatively low wages, really just trying to survive day to day. This is about one third of the folks in our community, the people who are greeting you when you walk into Walmart to pick up something for the kids. These are folks who are, you know, working, picking up the garbage on Monday mornings. People who are really, you know, struggling to get by, working really hard. And now you're going to put on them an additional requirement of doing more paperwork to get access to health care. A lot of people are going to end up falling through the cracks because of that. And it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt our community.
And if I could jump in, I think, Congressman Riley, my understanding is that it's also the SNAP program that will impose work requirements. I think people think the SNAP benefits now are just, they're fine, they're in place. But the One Big Beautiful Bill Act is taking funding out of SNAP. Could you speak to that about how they're doing that?
Yeah, it's in a lot of ways the same issue. And again, I think most folks agree that if you can work, you should work. But what I think a lot of folks don't realize is that almost everybody who's in these programs is already working. And so what they've done to try to make cuts to the programs is just make it harder to fill out the paperwork, frankly. One of the things with SNAP that we saw during the government shutdown recently is just it's so important across upstate New York. About one in six households have SNAP in upstate New York, and these are hardworking families. And what we saw when SNAP benefits expired was a huge amount of demand at the food banks and the food pantries. I volunteered at a whole bunch of those across the district. And one of the things that I was able to help lead the effort on during that period was pushing for the administration to go into a contingency fund, an emergency contingency fund that's available exactly for this reason, to make sure that folks aren't losing their food, having food taken off their tables. And the administration refused to do that and actually fought in court against it, which I think was both wrong legally, but it's also cruel, because I talked to so many families who were at the food pantries and saying, look, the food that I'm picking up today is going to get us through the week. But I'm really worried because our health insurance and the healthcare situation is getting worse and worse, and the electricity bills are getting higher and higher. And we ought to be investing in working families and not in CEOs.
So we're going to have a whole long, another program on single payer. But we've got one quick question for you from Wendy Barkhouse from Treadwell, New York. Where do you stand on the concept of a single-payer system, either in New York State or the Medicare for All that Bernie Sanders and others have talked about for single-payer for the whole country?
Yeah, look, I've always said I think healthcare in the United States should be a civil right and not something that is bankrupting families and driving insane corporate profits. There's a lot of ideas out there about how we make sure everybody has access to affordable, quality healthcare. I think there are lots of improvements that we could make that would do that, including things like, under the Affordable Care Act, there was the medical loss ratio, which basically said that at least 85 cents of every dollar you're spending on your health insurance should actually go to your care. Because what was happening before that is you have these massive insurance companies that are raking in ridiculous profits, and then they're spending it on nonsense like lobbyists and marketing materials and all that stuff. We should dial up the medical loss ratio and change that. I mentioned earlier for Medicare, I wanted to cover hearing and vision and dental. I think that's a really important change that we could make. I think a public option would be a really positive step in the right direction. Think about that as, you know, right now, if you want to send a package, you could go to FedEx, you could go to UPS, but you also have the Postal Service available. And if the private companies start jacking up their rates and losing your packages, you have a public option to go to. And I really think we need that in our healthcare system. So there's There's a ton of different ways to do this, but the bottom line is the current healthcare system is broken. That's especially the case in rural America. We're in this situation where the insurance companies and the drug companies are making money hand over fist. They're pumping all of it into, not all of it, but a lot of it into the political system with corporate PAC checks and lobbyists and rigging the system in their favor. And folks against upstate New York are getting squeezed and hurt in all of it. And so there's lots of reforms we need to the healthcare system and, frankly, the campaign finance system.
And, Congressman, we have, if we could just get one more question in. We have a question from Lisa. She says microbusinesses make up a large percentage of our local economy. A microbusiness is defined as having 10 or fewer employees. In a system where government studies can define a small business as having up to 500 employees, microbusinesses tend to fall off the radar. Do we know if and how the changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act will affect the healthcare for microbusiness employees?
Yes, and did Lisa mention by any chance where she's from or what town?
I want to say she's from Margaville, but I could have that wrong. I don't have permission to use her name.
No, that's okay. Yeah, no, that's totally good. I was going to try to think of a micro business in whatever town she was saying she was from. It's Margaville. I love my favorite's the Cauliflower Festival there, but so we do. We know it's going to be really harmful. It's already hard enough to run a small business or a micro business, and it's getting harder because costs are too high. You talk to a lot of these very small businesses, and you ask them what they're struggling with, and the number one thing is like the electricity bill just doubled in the last month. The input costs are going up, and now they're dealing with a situation where health insurance premiums are about to skyrocket on them. And so it's a really good point that she raises. Not all a small business with 500 people is much different from one with 10 folks. And we should really be supporting those small businesses because they are the backbone of our economy. And instead, what we've seen out of Washington is a situation where nothing is getting done to lower the utility bills. The folks who are in power in Washington are walking rural healthcare off a cliff, and we really should be supporting folks like Lisa and not making things harder for her.
And can you also just speak quickly about heating assistance programs? My understanding is there's some we're not so sure some of that heating assistance is going to continue, and it's so needed in our community.
Yeah, this is a major concern, especially because of what we have seen with the utility bills. I'm one of the biggest advocates for the low-income heating assistance program and to make sure especially seniors and folks on fixed incomes are able to stay warm and keep the heat on during the harsh upstate New York winters. One of the things we need to do in Congress is get Democrats and Republicans together to make sure there's enough funding for the low-income heating assistance program so that people aren't literally left out in the cold. One of the first bills I introduced when I got to Congress is a bipartisan bill that would help families. It would hire trades unions to help families weatherize homes so that sometimes it's as simple as, more insulation or more efficient windows. Things like those are very costly for families. They're unaffordable for a lot of families. But if you make the investment, it ends up saving you a lot over the long run. And so I want to hire the trades to make those home improvements. It's good for the trades. It's good for those families. There's a lot we need to do around heating assistance and energy efficiency.
Congressman Josh Riley, how can our listeners get in touch with you if they have concerns about these issues or need some help?
Thank you. Well, first of all, please do get in touch with my office, particularly if you need help with a federal issue. We take a huge amount of pride in our constituent services. We are here to help. And if you need help, go to our website, which is riley.house.gov. There's phone numbers there that you can call, and you can also submit a request there. And if you need help, please, please call us.
And one more time on that address.
Yep, it's riley.house.gov.
Right. Congressman Josh Riley, thank you so much for joining us today on Health Center in the Catskills. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. Looking forward to doing it again.
All right. Thank you and have a great day.
Thank you.
Well, I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Health Center in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20. And we hope some of you are listening to this Health Center special through MTC Channel 20. Also, if you're on the campus of SUNY Delhi, you can tune in at 107.5 FM. And, of course, from anywhere at WIOXradio.org. That's WIOXradio.org. And yes, I'm Diana Mason, the host of Health Center in the Catskills. And yes, we don't usually start until 2 o'clock on Wednesdays, but we're doing a 2-hour special today looking at the effects of federal changes in health and social policies on the health and well-being of the individuals, families, and communities in the Catskill region. I'm joined here by my co-host, Richard Siegel, a social work administrator and adjunct professor at Hunter College, and he teaches policy. So thanks for doing this again, Richard. We want to now turn to what is the, what the impact of these changes are on our local health systems. So we've been talking about the impact on individuals and families for cuts in Medicaid, for example. And so if you cut Medicaid funds, what happens to the hospitals that see people who are on Medicaid? If those people become uninsured, what happens to these health systems? And joining us today are two very special guests that I'm going to ask Richard to introduce. Richard.
So here I am. Thank you. So as Diana just said, the federal policy changes really are affecting people very much locally. It will affect our hospitals, it will affect our nursing homes, and all of our health systems. So today we are very honored to have two great representatives from two of the wonderful facilities that take care of all of us here in this community. We've got Carolyn Lewis, who is the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Bassett Health System, and Michael Hockman, who is the Executive Director of Margaretville Hospital and the Mountainside Residential Care Center. And as Diana said at the top of the show, both Diana and I are board members of Margaretville Hospital, so for full disclosure. We want to say welcome to both of you. We're very thrilled to have you here. We were also hoping that we would get the CEO of Delaware Valley Hospital to join us, but he could not do that. So the next time, hopefully. So Carolyn, let's start with you, if we can, for a quick minute. Hold on one second. Tell us what's going on. What impact has all of this had on Bassett thus far?
Well, thank you for having me. And I appreciate this conversation. And it's always great to hear from our congressman as well. So I do appreciate his time. So as far as Bassett is concerned, and, you know, we have a hospital, O'Connor, located in Delhi, as part of your catchment area. Right now, things continue to stay stable for our network. We are looking towards the future and, you know, trying to make as many adjustments as possible. But a lot of the immediate effects of the bill per se have not come into realization at the time. So, you know, we're not seeing some immediate effects. There are a multitude of factors. I mean, and I'm sure Michael will be able to talk about this. You know, we are here to take care of the community, and we will be here regardless, you know, of people's ability to stay insured. So it is important for us to, while there are a lot of cautionary tales, we do want to make sure that our patients and our community members know that we are here.
You're muted. You're muted.
Mike, yes. Mike, what about for the hospital system, Margaretville, and then the nursing home? What concerns have you seen, and what concerns are you anticipating?
Sure. First, I'd like to start off by thanking both you and Diana for having me on as a guest. I appreciate that opportunity. And I think I want to start by, you know, mirroring the sentiment that Caroline said, which is, you know, Margaretville Hospital and Westchester Medical Center have a moral obligation to care for anybody who arrives at our facility in need of care. And we fully intend on meeting that obligation, regardless of their ability to pay, whenever anyone arrives at our facility. I think it's important to step back, and I'm sure Representative Riley had mentioned this. You know, it's important to look at the numbers. You're talking about $911 billion in healthcare funding that's going to be eliminated. And that's concerning because Medicaid really forms the bedrock of the healthcare system for a lot of people. If we look at Delaware County specifically, we're talking about 25% of the population that is on Medicaid. Mm-hmm. We're talking about 10% of the population that gets their health insurance through the marketplace. And we already have an uninsured rate of 5%. And I think, unfortunately, what's going to happen as a result of this act is we will see the number of uninsured people increase. We will see the number of people seeking preventative care decrease. And we're going to see an increase in the number of people who are utilizing the emergency room and are experiencing what would be preventable hospitalizations if they were able to access that level of preventative care. What I can say is, you know, before this bill was even put in place, Margaretville had been looking at how it operates and trying to understand ways where we could improve efficiency and really deliver better care to all the communities that we serve. So we have been looking at things like, you know, implementing AI systems that can help improve clinical documentations, which leads to better patient outcomes. It also reduces staffing burdens, which allows for increased care capacity, you know, direct bedside care that our staff is able to deliver. You know, and we're looking at what the needs of the community are, and our full expectation is that we will continue to go out and meet the needs of the community by expanding services, regardless of what the budget implications or what the act's implications will have on federal funding. You did ask about the nursing home. There's no specific provisions in the bill that will have an immediate impact on the nursing home. We are paying attention to any concerns around recurring qualification requirements that may be implemented for Medicaid patients. There's a large percentage of residents who are with us that are Medicaid status, so we'll just be paying attention to make sure that there's no interruption to their long-term care needs.
Can I ask a follow-up question to Carolyn? It's Diana Mason here, and thank you both for being here. So what percentage of your revenues come from Medicaid? In the Bassett System or O'Connor Hospital in Delhi, I don't know if you're that granular.
Sure. So our population figures mirror what Michael is talking about. You know, we're seeing about 22%. You stratify that, though, across age groups. So our school-based health, you know, we're talking 60% of children are covered by Medicaid. Most people think that long-term care is covered by Medicare, and most of those patients receive payments from Medicaid. You know, nursing homes are in a even more of a challenge. You know, reimbursement rates from Medicaid have not been increased since 2008. And so, you know, it's an underfunded program to begin with. And then you add on these additional stressors. You know, the number of uninsured will increase because, again, as we said in the beginning, we will not turn anyone away. So we don't get to pick and choose who we serve. So those are, you know, that's sort of the stratification of where we are in terms of our population base. You know, one of the other provisions in this bill are other financing mechanisms that New York State used. So if we take a step, and I don't want to jump ahead and if you have additional questions, but, you know, in addition to the hospitals getting paid by Medicaid, New York State attracts a significant amount of money from Medicaid programs, you know, and in particular, those were put into New York State's budget that is going to have to be taken from other places. You know, in particular, the MCO tax was a huge...
Say what that is.
So there's a tax structure that New York State can leverage through the federal government to basically tax providers and then turn around and implement that into reimbursement rates and other health care provisions. And in January, New York State had entered into that program, you know, to the tune of about $1.6 billion that was going to help support the health care systems across the state. That was re-looked at in the HR 1. They made a moratorium of other states being able to replicate that waiver or that model, and then also provided a mechanism for the states that were enacting it to either cap it or to sunset it. So unfortunately, right now, CMS has made a ruling that that will sunset in March of 2026, which is going to put a significant burden on our state legislators to figure out how to continue funding health care if it's not coming from that money.
And then the One Big Beautiful Bill Act also, because of these cuts that you all are going to feel, so people are on Medicaid, as Michael, you were outlining, and Carolyn, you've been talking about, some of those people will be thrown off of Medicaid, and they will become uninsured. They will not get preventive care. They'll show up in your emergency rooms, et cetera. And the projected billions of dollars of loss to rural hospitals. So the One Big Beautiful Bill Act includes, though, a rural, I think there was so much pushback on that, that it includes a rural health transformation program. And my understanding is that it's to the tune of about $50 billion compared to potential cuts of over $150 billion in the regular Medicaid stream. Can you talk about this rural health transformation program? Because it, while it sounds good and it's getting a lot of publicity, my concern is this doesn't replace the revenue, the stable revenue stream that you get under Medicaid now when you're treating patients, that it's really more grant-driven, specific project-driven. Can you speak to that, Carolyn?
And then, yes.
And then Michael.
So there were two streams of funding. So there's the big pot of $50 billion, you know, under the Rural Health Transformation funding. That's broken down into two separate buckets, $25 billion in what they're calling, I think, baseline, Michael, you know, some sort of capture where each state, so New York State Department of Health submitted an application in November. Each state, all 50 states submitted an application to CMS. That $25 billion is supposedly going to be split equally between all states, so essentially $200 million. $200 million is not a lot of money for New York State to push around to help rural hospitals. There is an additional $25 billion where there is a little bit less guidance on how that's going to be deployed by CMS. They have some formulaic methodology for determining what states are going to get that. That is to be determined. So if we pivot back to the $25 billion, break it down to $200 million for New York State, we have general ideas of what New York State submitted is part of their application. And as Michael was talking about, investment in IT, you know, how to increase efficiency, reduce costs, and relieve practitioner burden. Working with more enhanced coordinated rural health partnerships, pretty wide open, you know, and obviously money to go towards increasing workforce, whether that's pipeline development, and so that folks have continuous access to both education and making it affordable. So those are what New York State is focusing on. How that's going to deploy back to hospitals or providers is yet to be determined. So we don't know. You know, we obviously have projects and programs we could apply for, that align with the state and federal goals, but we sort of a little bit in a wait and see how that money is going to actually hit the street.
Michael, any discussions on your end about how that fund might be tapped into?
Yeah, I think Caroline raised some excellent points. I mean, we're talking about a total of $50 billion split into two different allocations. The first round for $25 billion, which is hopefully going to be distributed evenly across all the states. But you know, to Caroline's earlier point, there is a fair amount of discretion in terms of how it's allocated to individual states. And it's based on approval of applications. So there's even some concerns about what the review process is going to look like and how they will score and grade those to judge which applications qualify. New York State was great about reaching out and asking for comments and suggestions in terms of what makes it into the application, what rural hospitals thought would be beneficial in terms of service, you know, enhancements or optimization strategies to make sure that they're really meeting the needs of the community. So there is a lot of hope that with that money, although it will not fully replace the $911 billion that's being pulled out of the Medicaid program, there's a lot of hope that those dollars can go to good programs that can really enhance the level of service. And our focus for Margaretville is really going to be making sure that we're working with as many community partners as possible to reach residents where they are. Delaware County has a very big transportation issue, and that's definitely highlighted in Margaretville. And anything we can do to enhance our ability to meet people where they are is only going to improve the level of care that we're able to provide and really reduce those unnecessary admissions to a hospital and the overutilization of emergency rooms as primary care.
So we do have one question from the audience, and Mike, this is to you, and I do know the answer, but I'm going to let you explain this relatively briefly. This is from Stacy Skelly in the Margaretville-Arkville area, and the question is the outsourcing of the Margaretville PT department a result of financial pressures the hospital is experiencing or expecting or because of the Medicaid cuts?
So the change in service for our physical therapy, occupational therapy, and speech therapy service lines is not a result of any changes in federal funding or Medicaid participation. That's really an effort that we're undertaking to really enhance the level of service that everybody who comes into contact with our care continuum experience. We want to make sure that we have fantastic outpatient physical therapy, and we want to make sure that same level of heightened service really touches every aspect from our long-term care setting to our subacute rehab patients that we have inside of the hospital. And we really want to make sure that we're aligning with the standard that's going to meet the needs of the community as well as mirror the services that we're providing throughout the rest of our system.
Thank you. And just very quickly, Diana, and then I'll let you go. Both Mike and Carolyn will be giving their contact information. So if anybody has any follow-up questions, and particularly on this, reach out to Mike, reach out to Carolyn. Go ahead, Diana.
So, Carolyn, I will share in a minute another listener question, but you mentioned your school-based health centers, and Congressman Riley said they were like doctor's offices. Well, they're run by nurse practitioners, and I want to do a shout-out to you all and to Jane Hamilton, I believe, who runs that and has done a fabulous job on this. And I know that Margaretville, at one point, the Margaretville School was looking to try to bring one there. Could you speak a little bit more about whether these school-based health centers are going to have to be scaled back, or is there a way to keep them where you have them and maybe even expand them? They're so important.
Well, I cannot talk more about school-based health. I love it too. I mean, as a mother of three, it's a game changer for working parents. And it's interesting, you know, when we talk about work requirements and things that are going to go into effect for Medicaid, having the school-based health centers is going to be crucial for parents who may have to go back to work. You know, it's not easy to take half a day if you have a manufacturing job or, you know, you live a half an hour away or you have to get to a medical center. So Thank you for your appreciation of it. And yeah, Jane does, and her team does phenomenal work. In terms of expanding them, a little bit outside my scope, I don't think that there are plans right now to expand. They are, it is a mission-driven service. We lose money on it. But that is a, you know, a commitment of Bassett to continue to put into their community. So no, we don't have plans to close them. No, we don't have plans to expand them. And we don't see any real impact of the bill. So
thank you. Another question.
I think
we should have one more.
Yeah, I have. I'm sorry, I was unmuted. This mute stuff gets to be challenging at times. So, one more question had to do with this idea of that we've talked a bit about, that it's assumed that many current Medicaid recipients will be dropped as a result of changes in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Since this population will no longer be able to afford preventive care, as you mentioned, Michael, can we anticipate increase in emergency medical events? And I think we can. You said that. But she's asking, are hospitals required to accept patients who have no health insurance? And if you are, who will pay for that treatment? Who wants to go first? Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I'm happy to go first. We are dedicated to ensuring that the care needs of the community are met, regardless of their status to pay. So if you show up at our emergency room and you're having a heart attack and you can't afford the coverage, we're still going to care for you. We're not going to ask you your insurance status. We're going to provide you the care that you need to make sure you're okay. And unfortunately or fortunately, we'll provide that care, but the debt that's incurred, it will go on our books as bad debt. And hopefully, and ultimately, it's a cost that we're going to have to absorb through operations.
Can I put on my social worker hat and add something real quick?
Yeah.
It will take a village for all of us to make sure that folks don't lose their Medicaid, that they know the recertification time frame, the pacing, and that we make sure they do that. Their eligibility should, you know, a lot of people here are meeting the work requirements, so their eligibility shouldn't change, but the hoops they have to go through to stay on it may continue. So again, we'll hear from the hub, we'll hear from other people. I'm sure both facilities have care navigators, care managers that will be helping people as well, but everybody needs to be proactive in terms of making sure the recerts occur when they're supposed to.
Carolyn Lewis, did you want to add anything to that?
No, I was just, you know, we do have population health teams and care navigators. You know, we will be working with our county public health departments and other community-based organizations to really help folks stay enrolled, right? The congressman was talking, this is an administrative burden for most. You know, most people are not taking advantage of the system. Most people will continue to be qualified. So when we talk about these cuts, and they are extraordinary and they are impactful, but there's a, you know, I don't want people to assume that they are not going to be eligible, right? We need to be able to help support our community members in making sure they are accessing all the resources that are available to them. You know, it just adds yet another stress for them. And as we see increases in, you know, stress and anxiety and depression, this is yet one more thing that has to go on their plate. And I urge everyone who is in the situation, use the hospitals. You know, use your public health departments, use your Catholic charities and your community churches. You know, they're here. And we all need to really be able to support one another. And so, that's really
thank you.
That's actually a great segue into the other question that we have, and I think we've all partially answered it, but I'm going to let Mike and Carolyn each have a quick go at it. Who will be responsible for communicating these healthcare changes, and how will the message get through?
I'm happy to go first. I think, Richard, to your point, it's going to be a community effort. It's going to be our case managers, our care navigators, our boots on the ground staff speaking and meeting with patients and families as they come through our facility. I think it's going to be handouts and literature that we distribute out to people we come into contact with when we're doing some of these tabling events at community events. It's going to be really constant communication and engagement with the community to make sure they're informed of the changes, the impact of the changes, and really ways that they can stay covered.
And I do want to point out in the second, actually the last half hour of this two-hour special, we've got Shelley Bartow, who's already here and listening, for the CEO of Delaware Opportunities, Keith Weaver, the Commissioner of Social Services for Delaware County, and Robin Williams, the founder and manager of The Hub, coming on. And so we should ask them as well how they are communicating these changes to the public. So really important issues. Well, before we move on, I'd like to ask Carolyn if people would like to contact Bassett Hospital. How can they get them the information? How can they do that?
Well, they're certainly able to connect directly with me if they would like to do so. Do you want me to provide my, I can say my phone number.
Sure.
My telephone number is 607-547-6912.
One more time.
607-547-6912. And my email address is Carolyn, Carolyn, dot Lewis, Lewis, at Bassett, Bassett, dot org.
And that's Carolyn Lewis, Director of Legislative Affairs for the Bassett Health System. Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This was lovely.
And Michael, how can people contact Margaretville Hospital?
Yeah, they can reach me a couple of ways. They can call the hospital directly at 845-586-2631.
One more time.
845-586-2631. Or if they would prefer, they can reach me by email. My email address is my first name, Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L. Got my last name, Hockman, Hochman, at WMCHealth.org.
WMCHealth.org. And that's Michael Hockman, the CEO or executive director, CEO, we'll take that, of Margaretville Hospital, is doing a great job at the hospital, as well as head of Mountainside Residential Care Center. Thank you so much, Michael, for joining us. Thank you both.
Thank you both.
And Diana, just very quickly,
yeah,
both of these folks will call you back. So please do not hesitate to call.
All right. Thank you. And just a reminder, I'm Diana Mason, and you just heard from my co-host, Richard Siegel. And this is a special edition of Health Center in the Catskills. And for those of you who are just joining us, we started at 1 o'clock, and we will go until 3 o'clock. The focus is on the impact of recent federal changes in health and social policies, at the effect of those on the health and well-being of the individuals and families in our communities, and how we all may be responding to that or could respond to that. If there are gaps in support systems, how do we all step up and help our neighbors and help our family members and our businesses, etc.? So this is Health Center in the Catskills, on live and local in the Catskill Mountains on WIOX Community Radio at 91.3 FM and at MTC Cable Channel 20. And a shout out to all of those who you are tuning in through MTC Cable Channel 20. And if you're on the campus of SUNY Delhi, you can listen to us at 107.5 FM. And from anywhere at WIOXradio.org. That's WIOXradio.org. Well, I also want to note that we are taking, we're compiling a list of the phone numbers, the contact information, the resources that you're hearing about during this special. And we will be taking that list and posting it on the Hub's website. And that website is the Hub with two B's, H-U-B-B, on Main, M-A-I-N.org, the Hub on Main.org, and on Health Cetera's website, and that is at healthmediapolicy.com. That's healthmediapolicy.com. And now we want to, for this second hour, hear more locally about from our towns, a couple town supervisors, and then to